Spend just a few minutes on the internet and you can see the broad range of things we human beings believe about ourselves and our world and the higher powers we may or may not answer to. We're good at accepting and adopting beliefs, but how good are we at challenging the beliefs we hold and even further letting go of them? Today's guest has been examining the answers to those questions for a long time. Dr. Carol Tavris is a writer, teacher, and lecturer and a fellow of the American Psychological Association, as well as a charter fellow of the Association for Psychological Science. Her books include several textbooks and Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts, written with Elliot Aronson and due for an updated release later this year. Carol Tavris, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Happy to be here.
I should point out that Carol is in town because she'll be speaking at the Stevenson Union Rogue River Room, Southern Oregon University, tomorrow night, Tuesday night, 7 to 9. About self-justifying delusions, what the mind's biases reveal about cheating, justice, love, war, memory, and the rest of life.
Yeah, modest subject.
Just
coverage.
A good catch-all sort of thing. So right off the bat, what is a social psychologist, and how does this differ from the
anything else?
Garden variety
yes,
psychologist?
Exactly. Well, thank you for asking that question, because I live in Los Angeles where people think a social psychologist is a therapist who gives a lot of parties. You know, I
mean, it's social.
That's the social part. The rest is therapy. I think most people have a notion that if you're a psychologist, you're a therapist, and it's important to understand the difference. Psychology is an enormous field that has some psychotherapists, clinical psychologists at one end. Those are the people who do therapy, and they're the ones who kind of get the public attention. They're the ones talking about, you know, therapy and mental illness diagnoses and so forth. The rest of us are the people who do – that's the psychological science part, if you will. Those are the people who do research on child development or memory or war, prejudice, love, and so forth. Social psychology is one branch of – psychological science. It's the group of people who study basically a human being in social context, any social context. So that means we get to study everything on the planet, from love to war and everything in between. But it's a research field within psychology, and it is not clinicals. I am not a psychotherapist.
So you've never been a therapist?
I never have.
Okay.
Except, you know, with my friends.
And they don't even know it.
So
what led you down this path in the first place? I mean, your first degree was in comparative literature, is that right?
Oh, well discovered, my goodness. Yes,
it's comparative literature. It's easy these
days. Yeah, it's easy these days. You can run, but you can't hide. I found myself in graduate school studying the sociology of literature, which I had no idea what that was at all, and discovered this wonderfully interesting interdisciplinary field called social psychology at the University of Michigan, and I fell into it, and I loved it because we learned all the methods of psychological science and research and all of the topics, as I just said, ranging widely. So I flopped into that as a graduate school field, social psychology, and when I got my PhD, I went back to a magazine, a brand new magazine that I'd been working for called Psychology Today, on the beach in Del Mar, California. This was a heaven. This was the Camelot of jobs, let me tell you.
Oh, sure.
But that's where I learned to write about psychological science. The magazine in those days was meant to be the Scientific American of psychology. It was quite academic, but it was designed to translate science into useful information for the general public. And that's where I decided that's what I want to do for a living. That's what I love doing. And so the career I carved out for myself was pretty much that, taking my knowledge of social psychology, but writing about it for the public in books, articles, op-eds, et cetera.
And a particularly auspicious time in history, because your first work, I understand, was about generally about women and gender in the early 70s, which is probably a really rich vein to mine for material about how we hold on to assumptions about things like gender roles.
Do you know, looking back at everything I've sort of written and thought about over the years, I think that the guiding question for me has always been, how come when you say to somebody, here's some really interesting information that disproves what we always thought about this, isn't that fascinating? Now we can do this better. And they rarely say, why, thank you, Carol, for this incredibly useful information. I will now change my philosophy of child rearing immediately and my attitudes toward men and women. Thank you so much for the data. You know, they don't, right? And I guess in a way, that's been my driving inquiry. Yes, in the 70s, my dear friend Carol Wade and I wrote one of the first books in women's studies. It was called The Longest War, Sex Differences in Perspective. And it was an interdisciplinary look at why, given that men and women are two halves of allegedly the same species, we are so often at war? Why have, you know, what differences matter? What differences don't exist? What are differences caused by? Why do they change? So we asked a lot of skeptical and critical questions about the study of gender at that time. Women were pretty much invisible in psychology as research topics. If you put women in a study, they were forever doing things that men weren't doing. And so then it was considered women were just being strange and deficient and so forth. And of course, in the 70s, as women were beginning to enter graduate school in many different fields, they came with the questions that were of interest to them. And in that way began to change the way the science was done in psychology. So many areas of research interest that were interesting to men that were not interesting to the women who came in. And so as women entered the field, there were more subjects to study, more questions to answer. It was a very exhilarating time.
One of the things that I think you've mentioned along the way is that you don't particularly care for the term opposite sex when it was used for either gender in relation to the other.
Yes, thank you. The subtitle of The Mismeasure of Woman, which was an homage to Stephen Jay Gould's The Mismeasure of Man, is why women aren't the better sex, the inferior sex, or the opposite sex. And it used to get a great chuckle, and people would say, well, what are they then? You know, if we're not better and we're not worse. My mother said to me plaintively, we're not the better sex, sweetheart. Or the opposite sex. Yes, it's true. I don't like the idea of opposite. We aren't opposites. That is, we are not. To be one doesn't mean you can't be the other. And the thing that has always driven my interest in the question of sex differences has been the underlying belief that somehow men and women are fundamentally different and opposite. And as a social psychologist, what we see is that is so rarely true. So, for example, if we bunch up qualities in polar opposites, women are empathic and men aren't. Men are aggressive and women are not. Men are rational and women are emotional. These are the usual dichotomies and opposites for which there is no evidence. They're stereotypes, but they don't describe reality.
We'll hold the thought there and come back to talk more with Carol Tavris about taking and holding belief and maybe even letting go as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Carol Tavris, and your phone calls and emails in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Carol Tavris, a social psychologist based in Los Angeles. She's written many books, including Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts. So we're talking about belief today, how we come to our beliefs, how we hold tenaciously onto those beliefs, and sometimes in the face of all reason indicating otherwise. Carol will be speaking at Southern Oregon University's Stevenson Union tomorrow night, welcomed here by the Jefferson Center and as part of the campus's Revolution Series. You can join us now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email, or you can check out Carol's picture on Facebook. Talking about gender roles, your mother apparently was quite clear about challenging gender roles herself. So you grew up in a family where orthodoxy was never a cool thing.
This is very true. My mother got her law degree in 1927 in Chicago. Goodness, she was 21 years old. And she was always very feisty. She had no role models for becoming a lawyer. Her best friend followed her into law school because she had a role model, my mother, you know, but my mother didn't have any. After the Depression, she didn't work as a lawyer. She and my father came out to California from Chicago figuring if they were going to be poor, they might as well be warm.
Instead of poor and cold. Right?
Instead of poor and cold. But she was always independent. She always encouraged my independence, as did my father. My father was as much a feminist as she was. They just didn't see any reason to treat me any differently because I was a girl than a boy. And of course, one of the reasons I love being here in Ashland this time is that my father, who was a self-taught Shakespeare scholar, began teaching me stories from Shakespeare and soliloquies from Shakespeare when I was very, very little. So they didn't have an orthodox notion of what it meant to be a man or a woman. They were both very independent, and they believed in women's independence.
But they were sort of nominally Jewish too, weren't they? But again, challenged the orthodoxy there as well.
Well, they were secular Jews. They felt culturally identified as Jews, and anybody who survived, of course, through World War II, let alone, well, or before that, who endured anti-Semitism, you know, was not going to give up their Jewish heritage. And so, but they were secular. They, and what they hated most of all, I think, was religious hypocrisy. Religious hypocrisy. So on the Day of Atonement, Jews are supposed to fast. And their philosophy was, if you want to fast, fast. And if you don't want to fast, you don't have to fast. But don't say you're going to fast and then eat a chicken leg. Okay. Okay. So I had no religious upbringing. They were, yeah, they were free thinkers. So that was, and that's been a long strain in Jewish history anyway, is the free thinking movement. So that was my origins.
We have a call for you. Let's go to Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Carol Tavris.
Thank you. Right now in Muslim countries, we have Sunnis and Shias killing each other over something that happened 1,400 years ago. And religion is the second greatest cause of war. So my question is this. What is it about the human brain that makes belief so much more powerful than facts? Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Ann.
Well, that's a phenomenal question. That's the heart and soul of the issue, and it's fundamentally what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow. But I can give you this answer. There are a lot of aspects of human psychology that were at one time evolutionarily advantageous to us as a species. So it's beneficial to human beings. It's adaptive for us to bond into small communities and tribes. Human beings would not have survived on their own, rattling around like loose marbles. You know, we needed community. We needed to bond to that community. And one of the things that binds us is not just our sense of family connections and community relations, but our beliefs. The notion that our group is the best group, this is ethnocentrism, is universal. In some languages, people are defined as us, and everybody else is not people. Anyone who's not us is not quite human, certainly is not as good as we are. Now, you can see how, you know, thousands of years ago, this would have been of benefit to us as communities. First, to feel that we're better than everybody else. Second, to develop a set of beliefs that explain the mysteries of the world and of life and death. Those beliefs would have been very important as a way of helping human beings understand the world and their place in it, to deal with tragedies, deaths, and losses, and to explain how and why you should behave as you do. So it would also have been adaptive evolutionarily for people not to change their minds every 10 minutes. You know, you don't, and this in a way is still true. You don't want to have to stop and think every morning, what's the data for brushing my teeth? Should I be brushing my teeth or should I change my mind about teeth brushing? We all live by our beliefs, and we need to. We need to have convictions and beliefs that guide us, that we think are important, our political beliefs, our philosophic beliefs, and so forth. The idea now in our modern, complicated world, I believe, this is my belief, is that what we need to do is have a little more humility about our beliefs and be willing to let them go when the evidence dictates that we should. That's what's so hard, because in a way we are asking our minds to counter the way they've been designed to observe the universe. And in a way that's the theme of Mistakes Were Made, and not by me, why it is so hard for us to even realize that we might be wrong or that we have done something hurtful or foolish. You ask, of course, about the great question of war. Well, that's huge. That's huge. There are many causes of war. And in many cases, religion is the justification for the reasons for going to war rather than the cause. We see this in the case of tyrants and despots who generate a war against outsiders as a way to solidify their power and control over their people.
Because people did respond to it, to the tickling of ethnocentrism.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, look what happened in Bosnia. You know, Sarajevo was a city of where the three great religions coexisted in tremendous harmony until Milosevic came in and said, no, no, we got enemies here, you know, and the enemies explain why we're doing so badly and so forth. I mean, so yes, beliefs can generate anger and war, and they can beliefs can also be generated by a war, by the need for a war. For example, very often we tend to think that prejudice is a cause of war, but very often war is a cause of prejudice. When there's economic competition between groups, suddenly we think that other group is evil, mean, wrong, stupid, incompetent, and terrible. And then when there's no need for the competition or for the war, our views of them change. This happened, for example, in the case of the Chinese arriving in the United States. When they first came and they were in the gold rush camps, everybody thought, no, the Chinese are crafty, stupid, and conniving. But then when we needed the labor of Chinese immigrants to build the Transcontinental Railway, oh, they were wonderful, hard workers. They were so terrific. And then after the railroad was built, you know, and they were competing with white southern men for jobs, and once again the Chinese became vilified. So what we in social psychology like to emphasize is that it's not – that beliefs and behavior is not a one-way street, and that we need to understand the outside causes of our beliefs as well as the way the beliefs affect our behavior.
Carol Tavris is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a social psychologist based in Los Angeles and the author of many books, including textbooks, and she'll be speaking at Southern Oregon University tomorrow night, both welcomed by the Jefferson Center, which is often dealing with realms of belief and non-belief, and also as part of the Revolution campus theme at Southern Oregon University. That'll be tomorrow night, Tuesday, May 5th, 7 to 9, in the Rogue River Room at Stevenson Union. She's here now to talk to on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join us at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email is jx@jeffnet.org. Check out Carol's new picture from our studio on our Facebook page. People love getting their picture taken at 9 in the morning, I find.
Yes, really. Thank you so much. Glad I wore this red sweater.
It's a belief I have. People love to get their picture taken at 9 in the morning. So when we talk about letting go of our beliefs, though, and particularly when in the example that our caller gave, it seems like a lot of it begins to get back to, well, I'll consider mine when you consider yours. Mm-hmm. Does it seem like humankind are very prone to that sort of behavior, too?
Yes. Do you want me to say more about that?
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
Yes.
I love this. One of the basic biases in the way the mind works is the bias that I'm not biased and you are. There's been a lot of research on the I'm not biased bias. It's quite funny in a way, but it is also very profound because it means that if you and I are having a conversation, by definition, am seeing things correctly the way they are. I'm right because I'm not biased, I'm not prejudiced, I'm not racist, I'm not sexist. I see things as they really are. Therefore, if you are disagreeing with me, something's the matter with you. See? So in a way, the heart and soul of our book, Mistakes Were Made, is to show people why this bias exists, how we might think about overcoming it, and how it operates in our relationships internationally as well as interpersonally, because it's fundamental to the nature of disagreement. I'm right and you're not, and so don't tell me I'm right. One of the funniest reviews that we got from a reader who said, boy, you know, you start reading this book and you think, boy, this applies to everybody out there in the outer world. And then he said, halfway through, you think, boy, this really applies to my family and my parents and my kids. He said, by the end, you think, oh, maybe this applies to me too. That's our goal.
Have we reached a point in human history, particularly in American political history? Let me not generalize for the humans too broadly, but certainly it seems like in American political discussions, if you can even call them that anymore, the eyes rolled, I should tell our listeners, that we've gotten to a point where we begin not only with the assumption that I'm right and you're wrong, but that I'm always right and you're always wrong.
Yes. Well, that's been the great, horrible evolution of our political process in this country. obviously, you know, there have long been political parties with different philosophies of how the world should work and what kind of political choices we should make. The awful thing that has happened in America is that the polarization, which used to be ideological but not practical, In Congress, it used to be, you know, Orrin Hatch and Ted Kennedy could go to lunch and were good friends that could hash out some resolution to some bill that they would otherwise have ideologically been opposed to. And it wasn't considered shocking to members of either party that they would do that. That's what politics is, the art of compromise. The danger in our culture now is that compromise has become anathema. You know, that's selling out, you know, to have breakfast with someone from a Democrat?
The enemy.
Well, the enemy, exactly. And so if you see people who have different opinions from yours as being the enemy with whom you cannot speak, talk, and come to compromises with, this is a disaster for the political process.
Does it come from religious belief? I know we've had guests on before who have more than suggested but wrote entire books about the idea that the ironclad, I am never wrong ideology of the right wing, in this case, comes back to Christianity and the binary look of that, you know, there is right and wrong, there is black and white, there is A and B.
No, I don't think so. You say Christianity. Christianity is a huge thing. You know, I mean, and for that matter, any ideology, whether it's feminists or Republicans or Democrats or Christians or Jews or anybody else, there are fundamentalists who are ideologues who believe they're completely right and there's no other way of seeing the world than my way, whatever the ism. And then there are many people within that belief system who are flexible and tolerant and not so doctrinaire. I mean, it's been very interesting, for example, to see the evolution of Christians in their views of slavery, which Christianity, of course, endorsed for 2,000 years. And then suddenly, well, you know, wait a second, can we just change our minds about slavery here? Gay marriage, certainly, or attitudes toward gay people. Look how fast that has changed among Christians, too. So it's not the religion that does this. It's the impulse toward a fundamentalist strain within any religion that's the enemy to me.
Okay, we have another call on the line. Carol Tavris is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, social psychologist. We're talking about our beliefs and how we adopt them and hold on to them tenaciously. Julian Ashland is our caller. There we go. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Carol Tavris.
Hi, I hope you can hear me well.
Yes.
Thank you. I was wondering if, Carol, if you go into in your teachings and studies and your book into the phenomenon that our minds have to go into projection, and basically from a conditioned, preordained set of beliefs, often quite unconscious. And do you have any ideas on how to heal that?
Well, I think you need to be a little more specific. What do you mean by projection?
Give me an example. Let's say someone is doing something that I don't like. It's triggering me, and I'm having a reaction in myself, and I tend to want to blame them and want to stop their behavior rather than taking responsibility for the feelings inside myself that are being triggered and healing that.
Well, you've just identified it, haven't you? You have just identified the human ability to do precisely that, to stop in mid-judgment and mid-blame the impulse to say, you're the one who's doing the wrong thing here, and say, wait a minute, do I have some part in this dilemma that we have? Whether you want to call it projection or not projection, of course it's the case that people around us have the irritating capacity to irritate us. Isn't that annoying?
That's weird.
I just find that so annoying. Why don't they just behave? But so of course they do, and you call it a trigger, and yes, it does. People will do things that are extremely irritating, and they trigger your reaction. But in your question, you have the answer, which is your ability to understand that this person is behaving in a way. I wish they wouldn't do that. It makes me feel this way. Now, the consequence, I think, of your understanding of that is a better way of dealing with a person who's making you annoyed or irritated, which is instead of saying, "You blithering twit, how could you be doing these things to me?" You can say, "I'm feeling this way. I wish I weren't feeling this way, but I'm upset about what's happening here between us, and can we together figure out a way to resolve this problem?" That is in a non-emotional and non-accusatory way. So yes, other people do trigger our responses. Yes, those triggers are often of unconscious connections to why we don't like their behavior. And finally, yes, we can change that.
So, but it is a second step, though, for a human being to be able to say, "I could be wrong." It's never the first one, right?
It is never the first one. It is almost never the first one. But to me, one of the things, you know, Elliot Aronson, my co-author on Mistakes Were Made, is one of the world's greatest social psychologists, nominated by his peers as one of the great social scientists of the 20th century. And he has always been a big proponent of understanding how and why we are able to change behavior that we justify as being inevitable. That's just the way I am, we say.
Yes. Okay. We can talk much more about the "just the way I am" school of things, and talk about other biases and beliefs that we grab and hold on to tenaciously, sometimes to our detriment. Carol Tavris is our guest, the social psychologist. She is the co-author with Elliot Aronson of "Mistakes Were Made, But Not by Me: Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts." More discussion with Carol and more of your phone calls and emails. Welcome on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the social psychologist, Dr. Carol Tavris from Los Angeles, who is in Ashland for a speaking engagement. She'll be speaking tomorrow evening, May 5th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University in Ashland, to talk about self-justifying delusions, what the mind's biases reveal about cheating, justice, love, war, memory, and the rest of life. Nothing like a narrow focus to really pull things in. Yeah. So you can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange right now with Dr. Tavris at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org, or check out Carol's picture on Facebook. It seems like what the core of what you're talking about here is critical thinking, to being able mm-hmm. to step back and look critically at not just what other people are thinking, which we're great at, but at what we are thinking as well.
Yes, absolutely. That was another theme, really, of my parents' training, if you will, which is, why is this so? Why do we want to believe this? My parents used to – we had a little Democratic family. Anybody could call a family meeting.
Really?
Yeah, really, including the kid. If something was upsetting us or distressing us, or that we, you know, felt was an improper, you know, rule. And critical thinking, I think, has always been a part of my upbringing. It was the one aspect of my parents' Jewish upbringing that they most liked, namely the idea that Jews are always arguing with God and arguing with religion. And Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof is always complaining, you know, complaining to, why have you done this? You know, and so that whole attitude of constant assessing beliefs, thinking about this, does this, you know, why are we doing this? Why do we have this practice? What does this tradition mean? What does this accomplish? And I love that spirit of inquiry. One of the interesting things for Elliot and for me in doing our book is, and this has been such a revelation to both of us, the fact is that when people admit that they were wrong and say, "Boy, you know, I really screwed up on this, I'm sorry," or, "Gee, I get now how much I hurt you when I did X, Y, Z," the world doesn't come to an end. In fact, not only doesn't it come to an end, it's very rare that the other person says, "How dare you apologize to me? You know, I'm furious at you now." Okay? In fact, it's like putting down a boulder that you've been carrying around for days or weeks or sometimes years for people to finally say, "Oh, I see my part in my life story. I see my part in this rift that we've had for many years." my husband, who was Irish, of course, it's a culture of rifts and grudges. You know, the Irish Alzheimer's is you forget everything but the grudges. Did you know that one? Right. But he learned to give up the grudges. See, that's really the key. And to do that, you have to stop saying it's this grudge, this rift is always from the other person's side. And this is the fascinating thing to me. We put a lot of mental and emotional energy into preserving our sense of rightness. But when we're able to say, you know what, in this case, I was really wrong, the results are often so beneficial. They're beneficial emotionally, psychologically. They're beneficial practically. Doctors are able to move on to better methods of medicine, you know. So it's an interesting irony that the very thing we that would benefit us so much, we are often so resistant to doing.
But you are not the first person to say such things by a long shot. And so, which raises the question again, what in our nature makes us cling so tenaciously to the beliefs, even in the face of all contrary evidence, or to use your analogy, to hold that boulder, to keep holding that heavy, heavy burden for as long as we do in the face of knowing, you know, if I would just apologize and admit I might have been wrong, we can get someplace here.
I think you have to come to the talk tomorrow night. This is going to require more than a sentence to answer that one. Or you could just read the book and send me a bunch of questions. No, I mean, that is what I'm going to be talking about. Why do we hold on to this, to these beliefs when we should give them up? So can I wait until tomorrow night?
Sure.
Okay.
But I'll give you another one here because callers to the show, getting back to the subject of critical thinking in general, frequently bemoan the decline in critical thinking. In your opinion, has there been a decline in critical thinking? And if so, what brought it about?
A decline in critical thinking. Well, I would say there's evidence for a decline and evidence not for a decline. You know, that's one of those things. Looking backward, we all lament how society is going to hell in a handbasket.
Things used to be so much better.
Things were so much better. I have this wonderful speech from the head of the Modern Language Association lamenting how undergraduates, you know, haven't read Hamlet and they don't know anything and they're so ignorant and stupid, and that was said in 1911. Okay, so I keep that quote on my bulletin board. Usually when people say the decline of critical thinking, they're thinking about why people aren't thinking critically about the things that they are thinking critically about, whether it's political or social and so forth. I think no question that our educational system has been suffering from the growth of kind of rote education. I mean, critical thinking movement, which emerged in the 1970s out of philosophy, and I remember thinking at the time, wait a minute, wasn't critical thinking movement, didn't we call that education? You know, I mean, why is it a separate thing to bring critical thinking into education? Yes, critical thinking is difficult because it requires, it looks like, the decline of scientific thinking. It's in a way the same thing. Critical, scientific, creative thinking in which you're willing to put your beliefs to the test, to the empirical test, see if there's evidence for them, and then let them go if you're wrong. That is difficult even for critical thinkers to do. You're never a perfect critical thinker. It's a muscle you have to keep exercising. And I fail this test several times a day, I'm sure. So I think when people lament the demise of critical thinking, we're thinking of the important issues in the world in which existing vested interests are resistant to evidence that they're wrong. I mean, of course, global warming, climate change, the big international issues for our planet and for our lives, where we see over and over and over again the Republicans who will not accept the data. Now, that's not a failure of critical thinking. That is a support of my economic livelihood. And let's keep in mind that most people will do that faced with any evidence that's going to jeopardize their livelihoods, whether we're talking about poor people who want to continue fishing in an area where the fish will be depleted, or farmers, or poor people in Africa who use malaria nets for fishing purposes instead of using them to protect themselves from malaria. Livelihoods come first, and people fear the loss of their livelihoods and incomes, whether they're poor or whether they're vastly wealthy. So the solution is not to say, I'm happy to have this evidence that's going to require me to change my job, but to help people continue to work, have those jobs, and find other ways of preserving their livelihoods. For the wealthy are always going to reject evidence that jeopardizes their privilege.
Wealth protection, as it has been described by some other authors. Mm-hmm. When Carol Tavris is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, social psychologist, we're talking about beliefs here. When we talk about critical thinking and exercising that muscle, it gets back to something you said earlier about, you know, we have to have certain things we make assumptions about. You know, it's a good idea to brush your teeth when you first get out of bed in the morning, things like that. It seems like then a good way to begin to move toward making sure that we can keep the critical thinking muscle well exercised is to challenge one set of beliefs a day, or at least question one procedure we do every day or something. Is this a good way to go about it?
Well, it depends. Well, you have the time? How many procedures?
I can skip brushing my teeth once in a while.
Well, you know, in our professions, in our livelihoods, I think it's crucial for people to be mindful about what it is they're doing and to ask themselves, are there better ways of doing these things? Doctors, technically, not technically, doctors are supposed to be keeping up with the research literature so that they are doing the best procedures. But consider what it must have felt like for the last surgical oncologist who did the last radical mastectomy in America, when we knew that lumpectomies were just as effective for women. You know, you want to be able to say, you know, I got to give up doing radical mastectomies. Look at these women that have been disfigured because of this mechanism. It's not easy to do, to change our practices, but it is important for the work we do and for the lives of those around us.
I know that we run across a fair number of people through the years from the point of view that religion is a very good thing because it gives us something like a moral compass. And I wonder where you weigh in on the idea of we can come up with a moral compass
just fine without
a greater power.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we can and do and have and will. Well, that's justifying religion is what that is. I mean, I have a belief in this religion. And therefore, I'm going to find every possible reason to justify my belief in that religion, including that it gives me a moral compass. We will overlook the hypocritical practitioners of my religion. We will overlook the ways in which religion has caused war, prejudice, and injustice. And we will, we will make this claim. So those are from people who use their religion as a moral compass. And many religious people do. I have an oncologist friend, a deeply religious Jew, and humane in magnificent ways, who has taught me, for example, he said, Judaism teaches him the difference between prolonging life and prolonging death. And it has helped him to understand that doctors are not obligated to prolong death, as the state of Oregon has pioneered, by the way.
With death with dignity, yes.
Absolutely. So, but he is such a good, decent, loving, and humane person that is what he finds in his Judaism. Other equally devout Jews would say, no, you have to keep a person alive at all costs. You know, so my view is that people bring their values and their moral compasses into their religious beliefs. It's not the religion that's teaching them the moral compass. It's that they have a moral compass and they find a course of action in their religion. That's why plenty of people who I would regard as being immoral, unethical, hypocritical, and otherwise appalling could likewise say it's my religion who teaches me to behave this way. You have the caller before who said about the Sunni and Shia battle for centuries is a good example of that.
I wonder then if ultimately it just gets down to us being social creatures. I mean, we do well in groups. We do much better in groups, it seems like, than we do as individuals. And if the adoptions of certain beliefs, even particularly non-religious ones, I mean, I look at the way that there are, you know, certainly camps of conspiracy theorists. You know, we can go off into chemtrails or 9/11 was an inside job or any one of a number of different things that people do embrace and hold on to quite strongly if it makes them feel like they're part of a group. Now, there's not like what we talked about before with the members of the Senate, for example, who will never admit that climate change could be real. But so there's no economic benefit for them, but
social benefit and psychological benefit is huge. The beliefs we hold serve so many purposes. Yes, they bind us to a community. They make us feel right and righteous. They make us feel that life has a certain meaning and explanation. I mean, we are meaning-seeking creatures. We cannot exist without a search for meaning, whether it's arthritis symptoms or sinus headaches, as you and I were talking about earlier. We want to know why, not just who done it, but why did they done it? Wait, that doesn't sound right. But we want to know why. We search for meaning. We find faces in spaghetti and on billboards. We find, images around us. So we want explanations. We want explanations of why this is so. So for some people, those explanations are, my brain made me do it, and for some it's my childhood made me do it, and for some it's the conspiracy of crazy people are doing this to us. So the belief we settle on will have very powerful consequences for us. You know, if you believe that your behavior is biochemically determined, your actions will be different in coping with that problem than if you think, no, it's socially determined or a result of how I'm living my life or how I'm thinking, how I'm interpreting my experiences. So explanations are powerful determinants of how we behave, and they're important to us because they give us a reason for why we're feeling the way we do and for how we should be living our lives.
Is it a little too random and scary without that, without the sense of everything happens for a reason?
Oh, you betcha. You know, it'd be like we have science fiction movies that capture that particular terror. Yes, it's terrifying. It's completely terrifying. I mean, here's a wonderful example of this. Do we have time for one quick example?
Just a little
bit. Okay. There's a common phenomenon called waking dreams, which occurs as people wake up between sleep and wakefulness, in which you have what's called a waking dream, and you may see a goblin on your bed or a demon or a ghost. We have to explain that. We have to explain that. So the phenomenon of people who think they've been abducted by aliens who are sitting on their bed, that's their explanation. It works for them. The scientific one, you're having a waking dream. Not as sexy.
Not as fun. No, not nearly as sexy. Carol Tavris is a social psychologist. She'll be speaking at Southern Oregon University tomorrow evening at 7 at the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union. And you can get to see her in person then. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.